gatherings. Among a broad and diverse social justice community, it needs your support. With the generous support of musicians and artists, never mind all that. This Monday night, Dan Reed will be performing. He is a musician, joined by local artists Rafael Medina and Simone Rios. There will also be a silent auction of arts and crafts from Oaxaca. Donation is requested. That's this Monday, July 26th, from 7 p.m. until late at Encuentro Cinco, 33 Harrison Avenue, 5th floor, Chinatown. Visit encuentro5.org. That's E-N-C-U-E-N-T-R-O. Number 5.org.
And Impression for Change, the 35th anniversary poster show of Red Sun Press, is showing for the final time at the Harriet Tubman House in the South End. It's running now through August 27th. This retrospective chronicles the history of political activism in Boston from the 1970s to the present. Red Sun Press is a worker-owned printing and graphic design company in Jamaica Plain dedicated to social justice. The Harriet Tubman House is located at 566 Columbus Avenue, corner of Mass Ave, in Boston. Check out redsunpress.coop for more information.
And we're rather out of time. The views and opinions expressed on this program have been those of the participants and not necessarily the staff management of WMBR, the Technology Broadcasting Corporation, or MIT. I'm going to end with a short piece by the late Thule Kupferberg that I didn't get around to playing last week, that I think will fit in nicely with Music for Human Beings. It's kind of like that, only different. And I'll just have to fade out the World Saxophone Quartet, continuing the Ellington theme, which really is not the theme of oppression. But anyway, I'll be back in 2 weeks. Someone will be here next week. Stay tuned for Music for Human Beings. This is WMBR Cambridge.
Red and black. I see the White House and I want to paint it red. Rabbi Jesus whispers to me, Besser isn't dead. I see the Kremlin and I'm gonna paint it black. Clinton's toasting Yeltsin. Zdravia bourgeois hack. And then Yeltsin toasting Clinton back. He's saying, Das Vidanya, sex maniac. I spoke to Tolstoy. Emma Goldman's coming back. He just sat there writing on a shot of red and black. Black and red, coming back. Red and black, they're coming back. The homeless alien morphs to Newt's son of a bitch. The social being served up dessert for the rich. The lions of reason strobe the deep grave of your dream. The lamb of love hides in the caves of academe. I hear the students as they wonder what comes next. They're forced to take the test, but do not have the text. They wander through the world wild internet. They still believe they'll find the Finland station yet. I heard Miranda General laughing in their hell. They said Bakunin had a funny tale to tell. Anarcho-pacifist Bolshevism never had its chance. Perhaps we could invite St. Francis to the dance. And St. Paul, hey, and Jacob Frank. I see the White House and I want to paint it red. Billy Rice is shouting at me, Bessa, beds and dead. Now Billy's roasting Yeltsin, so long bourgeois flack. I spied a Kremlin, hey, we gotta take it back. Red and black, get it back. Red and black, we're coming back. red and black, black and red, red and black, black and red, red and black, red and black, we're coming back.
Yes, 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 yes. Marhaban fi Music for Human. I am a Dr. Jalis Sakran, and I welcome you. Being a Dr. Jalis Sakran is more wonderful than you can possibly imagine. But some shadow of the experience may be felt by joining me here tonight. And those who are feeling it most intensely are here in person. And first among those is Professor Levine. Professor, welcome.
Thank you for welcoming me. And you too are welcome on the show, as are all our listeners.
Indeed, it is so. Thank you, Professor. Professor Levine is, of course, a Jewish mystic professor.
And I have to say that my pleasure in joining you and all our friends and all our listeners is of great magnitude, immense, deep, wide, and quite round.
This is all very excellent, of course, Professor, and we celebrate having you. Also beyond the glass is Aurora. Aurora, are you there?
I am here, Dr. Jalis. Thank you for having me on the show again, even beyond the glass. Such a lovely experience.
It is a great disembodiment, Aurora, but a wonderful one.
And for you as well.
Aurora, of course, is a vocal specialist.
I'm a vocal therapist. I specialize in the therapy of those through my voice and through their voice, and together expressing a more harmonious whole.
Indeed. Welcome, Aurora. And we also have our resident numerologist with us. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. I would like to wish everyone a harmonious evening.
And harmony also through the numbers, is that not right?
Yes, yes.
Excellent. Well, thank you again, of course, for joining us. And we also have two newcomers here for the first time, which makes them newcomers. We have a Dr. L, who is a master of the human heart and relationship.
Hello.
Welcome, Dr. L.
Thank you.
And sitting with Dr. L is Stanislaw, who is a pilgrim and a wanderer.
I am pleased that on my journeys I have found a place to stop.
Stop and rest, I'm guessing, and contemplate the joys of the heart.
And the unity of the soul with the outside world.
And truly in life, the journeys together with the stops are nothing more than more journeys. Perhaps slower in space, but just as fast and overwhelming in time.
Well, of course, in all our experience, we've always met those who have a wandering spirit, whether it be with regard to traveling physically or just having a bit of a wandering mind where their interests vary day to day. In fact, I'd say Dr. Jalis fits into this category himself. He's a bit of a mental wanderer.
Indeed, and I often find myself lost in thoughts that are like great caverns that one may become lost in.
A puzzle. A maze of the mind.
Indeed, a mental maze where one may wander, become lost, and be unable to return to a normal frame of mind.
I think this is our job here. It's basically to help guide ourselves and others through this maze, through this mental and spiritual maze, and reach that pot at the end of the maze, the pot of gold, the spiritual gold.
And indeed, to do so, to explore this mental cavern with a leash or a rope or a guiding compass, an albatross, so that one may return, perhaps without a map, but be without risk of being lost.
From my perspective, I see it as something of a topological problem. You are navigating the maze, trying to untie the knots. Untie the knots.
And yet what truth is there if there is no thought of being lost, no idea that you are taking a risk with your own soul and your own spirituality?
Well, I was actually going to ask Dr. Ella a question here. Being that she is a master of the heart and a guide, I wonder if you, Dr. L, have encountered people who have needed guidance through this spiritual and emotional maze.
Yes.
And is there any technique that you found useful for acting as a sort of beacon light for those confused and in wonderment and fear?
Open your heart.
Yes, I often say that myself to my disciples. I say, open your heart and find that divine spark within, because Jewish mysticism teaches us that we all have a divine spark. We all have a piece of God embedded like a kind of sliver of glass in our heart.
I think sometimes it is more important to open your heart without looking, without searching, just to be in that state of openness.
I see. So you close your eyes and you open your heart.
Exactly.
Well, that is such a beautiful thought, to allow yourself to plunge in, unknowing with your logical mind, but with your spirit so certain that you are going into a greater, wonderful, wonderful place.
Well, as always, the program is not only about being in that wonderful place, but about journeying to it together. So if you would like to journey with us to our wonderful place, the number is 617-253-8810. Caller, marhaban.
Hello?
Yes, welcome, caller.
Oh, thank you. I was wondering if we could talk about diets for a minute.
Please, I think diets are very relevant to the discussion we were already having.
Is this a diet of the mind or of the soul?
Both, a little bit.
Well, tell us, caller, your thoughts.
Well, I went to the doctor because I had urine in my blood, and they told me about there's a new diet where it's like a blood purge, basically, where you eat a lot of metal filings, silver especially, and it can turn parts of your body, appendages that flop around, silver and such. But that's actually kind of like, I go to a lot of goth dance parties, so that actually comes in handy. So I just, you know, you just bleed for a little while and the toxins just go right out of your body.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Do you feel more precious with these metals?
I would say like Gollum. All the way to Gollum.
Well, caller, you must be careful of those who tell you to do things which do not resonate properly with yourself. And you must remember that there are so many alternative medications out there that you must be careful.
We also, of course, all know the story and the myth of King Midas. King Midas yearned for gold so much that eventually he turned into a very, very, very beautiful gold statue, which is very highly prized by collectors today. I, in fact, in my own personal collection, own a sliver of King Midas's fingernail in pure gold at the moment.
And I always wondered about this concept of the Midas converting that which he came into contact with. Why was it that when Midas was instantly given this, the entire earth, it did not become a solid block of gold?
I think rubber acted as a resistance material. So he was wearing rubber-soled shoes, which meant that the gold power did not actually travel through his feet.
Well, more interesting to me in these stories is it always ends the same. And the third wish is the one constant. The idea that your wishes, they only lead to ruin and unhappiness. And then the third one, in a sense of melancholy and a desire to do what's right, you sort of do a spiritual diet and saying, in this third wish, I will do what is right for the world and fix what I have wronged.
Yeah, and I think this connects with Dr. L's point, because the point here is that wishes and goals are really part of our conscious directive of where we want our lives to go. And sometimes it's important to just shed those kinds of directives and just take a leap. Close your eyes and see where the waves bring you. See where the ocean brings you. See where the wheel of the universe turns and brings the individual. And I think sometimes that third wish actually represents the absence of wishing.
I wonder if the caller is still with us. I think we may have lost the caller. To me, the great question that we would like to have had answered is, how is it that the caller became aware that there was urine in his blood?
I believe any of a array of blood tests would give that sort of idea, although there is, I believe, urine in everyone's blood. It is one of those cycles that every substance in your body is intimately collected.
Indeed, as with the other humors. But it is an amazing and fortunate thing that he discovered this before his blood all became urine, and hence would pickle his brain. As the great Xuanggu, the ancient Chinese philosopher, would have said, he who has urine in his blood may at some point develop a pickled brain syndrome.
I've read that poem. It's very profound.
There is a lot of wisdom there, although it is very, very true, not very helpful to the person who finds blood that is mixed with urine in his veins.
Right, but I think the pickled brain metaphor really goes back to what we were talking about before, this idea of jumping off into the universe itself, jumping onto that universal wheel and letting the waves of the universal ocean carry you to wherever they want you to be instead of where you want to be, sort of submerging your ego. And I wonder if Stanislaw, the wanderer, the pilgrim, have you ever had any experience just, instead of choosing a place to go to, just letting some sign, some natural phenomenon carry you forth?
Indeed, I think it is true that the greatest travelers will tell you that they have been nowhere. For the true journey is the journey into the labyrinth of the mind.
And so this is this how you discovered? I mean, I know that you and Dr. L are very close to one another. Is this how you connected, because you discovered that your wandering was really a metaphor for the wandering of the heart? And Dr. L, as a healer of the heart, was able to sort of soothe that wandering spirit within you.
Yes, the flaws and the holes in my soul I found were very kindly treated by the magnificent Dr. L.
It all speaks to the power of an open heart.
I think we all need some sort of Dr. L in our lives, some sort of goddess of compassion who will sort of radiate those rays of compassion and mercy upon us and help us open our heart and close our eyes.
It is truly like those wonderful ladies that bring cookies to you, but instead of cookies, she brings to you an open heart.
Indeed, and the one may also remember the ancient Eastern philosopher Tyler, who mentioned that the cookie was the pathway into the heart of the man.
Now I believe that's the source of the Eastern tradition of the fortune cookie, which tries to delve into the fortunes of the hearts of men.
In Western culture, it is apple pie that will take you into the heart of the man.
Well, I've read that the original fortune cookie was actually, the message was originally written and burned, and the ashes of the burnt fire were then incorporated into the dough of the cookie. So it was actually much more subtle than a modern-day fortune cookie.
So you have to read it like tea leaves, or...?
Well, you never know exactly what your fortune said. You just... It's like Dr. L said, you close your eyes and you eat the cookie, and that cookie takes you somewhere. And you just have to sort of accept that... You'll live wherever it takes you, just like Timothy Leary said when he was experimenting with certain hallucinogens. He said that you take it and you wake up somewhere else, and wherever you wake up, that's where you wake up.
So, Professor Levine, I believe this reflects a very differing philosophy on how the fortune cookie will have the mechanism of divination, the modern view being that the will of the universe, or alternately the secondary subconscious awareness will bring you closer to the cookie that has your future in it. Mm. Whereas the more ancient view was that the cookie itself would, by its own mechanisms, in the process of consumption, change your future.
Well, I think this really does connect up with what we've been talking about here today, that there's this distinction between the modern man who has goals about his life, and he's always trying to achieve those goals. And I think sometimes we get a little too caught up in those goals, and we forget that life itself is riding a very powerful wave, and that wave is not under our control always. We can maybe shift the wave here and there with a little rudder, but we can't actually direct the wave. We have to ride it.
And the only way to shift the wave is to notice that it is there.
To know that there are forces beyond your control, you mean?
No, to notice the wave itself.
To notice those forces.
If you always look ahead, you don't notice the wave.
Ah, I see.
I might point out on the other side of things that one can tack against the wind, sail against the wind, if you travel very carefully, very well planned.
Mm. But our souls, I think, are not sailboats. Mm. They're more like soul boats.
Is it possible to travel faster than the spirit wave?
That is a question I've often asked myself.
Maybe if you have two side by side.
Two spirit waves?
Mm-hmm.
It depends on if the wind is against your back.
Let's bring another voice in to celebrate and to blow on our backs. Caller, marhaba.
Print customer 61790.
It seems once again that the...
I think we have been the butt of a joke.
I think the robotic listener is once again reaching out and with a limited voice.
It can be difficult to communicate.
It calls to us.
But I find that sometimes communicating through voice alone can...
Are you coming to my rear cross party tonight at 58?
Huh. But I find that communicating via voice can actually simulate what life is like after we die, that kind of sea of souls that will exist where we don't interact through the physical medium of the material world, but only through our spirits and our souls. And I think sometimes radio as a medium can simulate that sort of otherworldly communication.
There's especially this link, the airwaves, the radio waves traveling on nothing to reach everyone.
This is a very, very much meditation analogy that is worth being aware of, that when one meditates, one can cast one's soul outward, or for other words, one's spirit, because soul has so many other meanings. It's a loaded word. That one may cast the spirit out without it relying on another medium to exist. Simply it exists. I spent several weeks trying to understand the feline psychology. And I embedded myself within many, many different felines and realized that their association with the primates was one that was passed down from generation to generation. I gradually found the progenitor of the domestic feline, realized that they had not been tamed, but that they had tamed us. At some point, the great progenitor, which I will call Frankenstein, it discovered that by making certain sounds, It was able, surprisingly, to yield a very nurturing effect in certain primates.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's true. Actually, the sound of the mewling cat, who looks at you appealingly with those large eyes, closely mimics the crying of your child.
I think the human female has also learned this lesson very well.
And I think we can see that the relationship of the cat to the primate has been handed down. It's still electory. The cat can leave, and indeed the woman at whim.
Well, it's very interesting. I've read a study about the idea of humans having pets. It's a very interesting idea, and it's, of course, relatively recent in human history. We've been around for hundreds of thousands of years, but have probably only had pets for the past, I don't know, 5, 6, 7,000 years. And it's an interesting relationship where we care for the animal, we treat it as something to be cared for, but yet we dominate it. So it's this combination of dominance and affection at the same time. And I think that kind of paternalistic relationship does is connect to something deep in the human soul, that humans sometimes have this desire to care for something and yet to be in charge.
I must say that on my travels, I have found that sometimes the best companions can be found in the animal kingdom. I once wandered up a mountain accompanied by a toad. Like the best companions, he was silent.
Did he perch on your shoulder, or on your hand, or your head?
Upon making the acquaintance of this particular toad, I decided to mimic his progress, and I followed him.
So you were the companion.
So, interestingly enough, this connects back to Dr. L's point, though, where you took sort of a sign of that the universe was giving to you, or you interpreted this appearance of the toad as a signal, as something that you should follow. So you sort of shed your goal and you wandered according to the dictate of the whole universe or some higher power.
In an attempt to receive and unlock that truth which was contained within the toad.
Well, I think toads, as humans do, have a divine spark. And this is the spark that lies at the end of that mental maze that Dr. Jalas mentioned. And I think part of what we're trying to do, and I think what all of us should be trying to do, is to sort of expose that divine spark by opening our hearts and closing our eyes and clenching our teeth.
Toads are actually symbols of transformation.
Because in the desert, they can survive through the long summers awaiting the rain.
But I think Dr. L is probably referring to the metamorphosis of the tadpole.
Mm-hmm.
And I think metamorphosis is really a great image. And humans, of course, don't physically metamorphize. Metamorphosize.
That is after being born.
After being born. Whereas many other species actually go through more varied life cycles where they spend half of their existence as, say, some earthbound creature and the other half as some beautiful creature of flight.
And yet, Dr. Professor Levine, if you look at the human in its entirety, not just its physicality, we do not stop metamorphizing.
Yes, that was exactly my next point, that we can actually take the lesson of these creatures and say we too are continuously changing, and not only are we continuously changing, but if we choose to, we can make a sharp break with the past, and we can say, now, today, I will metamorphosize into a completely new being.
And we do this continuously without realizing it.
And if you look at the animal kingdom, usually the transformation is into something more beautiful.
Indeed, it is so. I at one point discovered that I was changing, and when I realized this, I felt for a moment that I could control my own change, to change the rate at which I changed. And so I raised this rate. I increased the change speed until suddenly I found for a moment, which seemed to last for a very long time, perhaps it felt like more like 5 moments, I was perfect. And then I kept changing because I could not change the rate of change quickly enough, and found that I had hurtled into a very terrible configuration. I was a very wicked person for almost a week before I recovered.
Yes, I think this is possible. I think, unlike the butterfly, we often do and can metamorphosize into a less wholesome being. Sometimes we can actually get further lost in that maze, in that thicket, get further away from the divine spark, close our hearts even more than they had already been closed. This happens to people. It certainly does. And it's just part of human nature, and it's something that we have to be aware of.
I'm very, very sorry.
Yes. And of course, if any of our listeners would like to share their own experiences of metamorphosis, of change, our number is 617-253-8810, and we'd really love to hear about your own stories and your own tales.
Caller, marhaban.
Hello?
Yes, caller, welcome.
How are you today?
Yeah, I'm well, thank you, caller. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Caller, if you would please turn down the radio or to step away from it.
Oh, I just turn it down there, yes. Okay, how's that?
Thank you. Thank you. Very, very nice.
That's great.
Give me my food. Shut up.
So,
sorry.
So, caller.
That was my younger brother.
Your younger brother, caller.
No, I don't want to talk about him.
Well, what would you like to talk about with us?
Caller! Sorry. I would like to keep on our conversation of metamorphosis.
Well, caller, have you undergone any striking metamorphoses recently in your own life, or do you wish to undergo some change?
Well, about 2 years ago, I traveled into the Tibetan mountains with my uncle. He's Thorsman. And we discovered a small cave. We went into the cave and found out a very, unbelievable object. It looked sort of like a roundish...
A roundish...
Excuse me, I'm sorry.
A round
it
object.
It looked kind of like a round sphere with golden pebbles ingrained inside of it. And I picked it up. And I felt an overwhelming sort of euphoria throughout my body. And ever since then, I have followed the Hindu faith. And I could not tell you what overcame me about this sphere, but it made me follow the Hindu faith for the rest of my life.
Well, this may have been a representation of the male testicle. I think in the Hindu scriptures there are descriptions of natural objects that seem to represent the creative organs, the procreative organs of both the male and the female, so referred to respectively as the yoni and the lingam. And so these are natural manifestations of like slabs, stalactites that seem phallic in nature and are thus worshipped as a manifestation of God and his creative abilities, and I think you may have stumbled upon a testicular version of this phenomenon whereby you experienced that creative energy, that creative force.
Mm. Well, let me offer an alternative hypothesis, Professor Levine. One hypothesis that
Shut
I have...
Up,
ooh. One alternative hypothesis I have for our caller is, of course, that from the writings, the scripture of Shangao again, or is it Gu?
Gu. I believe it is Xuangu.
Xuangu, who wrote that there are objects that have an indescribable nature, or a roundish one, where the object would convert the carrier into a deity, briefly, and then to plunge them back into the darkness of confusion, gradually, yet almost immediately. And so I wonder if our caller, our rather obscene caller, may have stumbled across one of these.
Of course, most of these objects are actually kept by the Vatican as well as the CIA.
Now, I must interject here, having read several of Xuangu's extraordinary novels. I believe that he meant this in a metaphorical fashion, that this object would embrace the mind of the observer with this feeling, this gushing feeling of deity, of connection with the universe and of being supreme, and that slowly, as the object's affinity wore off... The person, the observer, would find themselves plunging back into mundanity.
Aurora, I wonder if perhaps, like all of Xuanggu's writing, that the metaphorical truth and the literal truth are both embedded in every statement. And
yes,
I wonder if the caller himself is not evidence of the literal possibilities.
I mean, if the literal truth were not there, if these objects didn't exist, then how could we possibly explain the great spiritual power of the Pope?
I believe Xuanggu is teaching us of the great simultaneity of being, that at once the mundane and the divine coexist. For divine energy, just like radio waves, flows all around us. And at some moments, alone in the desert, I have found myself to be a conduit for the divine. Much as a river may shift its course, I briefly found myself immersed in the divine.
Your words are wonderful poetry, and your voice exhibits to me a sense of calm understanding.
Thank you, Aurora. It is an understanding that is available to all of us, if we but listen.
I think this sense of duality that we all associate with Xuanggu's work is stereotypical of any poetry. That's what poetry is.
I am more interested in the aspect of the round. In our lives, we worship the round in the way that women are round and the earth is round.
And our mother's sun is also round.
And in my era, of course, the telephone was also round. And if anyone would like to join us, the number is 617-253-8810. Caller, marhaban. Caller?
Yeah, hi. It's Scott from Cambridge. How are you tonight?
Welcome, Cambridge Scott. Alhamdulillah, how are you?
Good. It's a busy night. There's you've got more hosts than usual.
It's true.
It's very warm.
No, you've got me fascinated again. Are you undermining the concept of goddess worship and that although there's a duality, under goddess worship, you're actually putting something external on a pedestal so that any energy that you put into it or any stamina...
I like this idea of the
pedestal.
Would
be more chasing an unattainable object or some type of...
Well, I think of these objects as a kind of mirror, as a focal point, where we can sort of take all the spiritual energy which we would like to accumulate into our soul and focus it via, let's say, a statue of a goddess of compassion, focus all that energy from all over the universe, from every corner, from every dimension, onto a single piece of stone, and then bow down in front of that and allow that energy to enter into our minds and our hearts.
And in my mind, there is really no reason to not attempt to achieve the unachievable. It is often these ideals that tell us how we would like to live, even if we are unable to master ourselves to a degree that would permit us to achieve these ideals.
This reminds me a bit of a question on the French baccalaureate exam, the exam that all French students must take upon finishing university courses. One of the questions is, true or false, it is absurd to desire the impossible. Explain your answer.
Of course, this question is asked in French.
In French, of course. But of course, the interesting thing is that the French expect their university student to, of course, give an intelligent answer as to whether or not it is absurd to desire the impossible. Of course, one would probably have to explain what absurdity is.
Well, I think the French know very well. They came up with absurdity.
Oh, they do eat frogs'
now,
legs.
I must admit that I missed the caller's question.
Yeah, Scott.
Hi, how are you, Aurora?
I am well, and yourself?
Fine, thank you. It's very nice to hear you tonight. They were discussing something that they consider phallic, where I mean, to tell you the truth, something that you consider phallic might just be depositing energy into space.
Well, I believe that the point was that the roundness of the stone can express so many things, and that beautiful spherical shape is seen so often in nature that it embraces such a wide variety of objects and sensations.
The symbol of the...
In a cause and effect?
Of the cup.
Exactly. Cause and effect, the wholeness of one's soul, unity, the shape of the universe, all of those things are embodied in the beautiful, perfect sphere.
And the unity of the two sexes. For we must remember that the procreative power of all human beings is divided between men and women, and yet is present in both. For both the ovaries and the testicle contain within themselves the power to create life.
Well, and in my mind, I appreciate your comment, Stanislaw, because in this culture, in my own culture, the woman is often regarded as the sole possessor of life, because the life truly seems to begin with the woman. But by comparison, as modern medicine has taught us,
genetics,
the men are not only an equal contributor to the existence of every child, almost equal, in many ways they produce more possibility of life regularly than women do.
Within each man, a million possibilities arise and vanish over the course of a lifetime.
Or indeed over the course of a particular evening.
Well, and that is not to say that... I believe that numbers are irrelevant here, for to say that there are a million lives within one man is to make one man a million times less important than a woman.
True. Well, let us bring a million more people onto the air with us. Caller 2, marhaban. Caller 2, are you with us?
Have you ever heard of catbortions?
Catbortions, caller? No, indeed, I have not.
Okay, well, one of the biggest problems on the planet right now is overpopulation. So what you got to do is, when your cat's about to have a litter, first of all, you spay them. And if by hand, or hook or by crook, you got to do it some way. Second off, if somehow they get preggers, you gotta go in. See, there are a couple techniques, and you should go to catbortions.biz. It's my part on GoDaddy's site.
Well, I believe this is such a salient point.
Our caller's voice seems to be slowly fading off into oblivion.
And yet we must remember that as happy as we are with our feline companions, that perhaps our companionship to them is detrimental to the world when they overcome it so completely that we must choose to either have the companion or to render the companion incapable of experiencing motherhood.
Indeed, the difference between the vermin animal and the wonderful decorative animal is a matter of scale.
I was actually just thinking about this the other night. Is there an actual scientific distinction between weeds and non-weeds, or is that merely a matter of human aesthetics?
I believe that there has been some research about this, actually, that when blowing wind through leaves, one can experience resonances, and those overtones, which are unappealing to the human ear, are expressed in an unappealing visual. So you can discover if your roses are weeds by blowing wind against them.
Well, because I did have this fear. I grew a beautiful garden myself of many types of flowers, orchids, roses, daisies, cannabis.
Yeah, cannabis is good. If you feed that to your cat, it'll just let go everything.
But I was just wondering, I had this paranoid fear as I was tending to my garden that the thought that these are all beautiful flowers was merely an illusion, and that truly these were actually weeds. And I was cultivating weeds, unbeknownst to myself.
I'm very, very sorry.
Well, Professor Levine, if those things are visually appearing to yourself, then to you they are not weeds.
Indeed. Well, and if the weed were visually disappearing, then it is possible that you would not even notice.
Is it not easier to grow a garden of weeds?
Ah.
So it is about the effort that is involved in the nurture of the garden.
You can nurture less and still have a full garden with weeds.
And perhaps it is the case that the universe wishes for us to grow a garden of weeds.
Right, so again, removing the ego, removing the human intention, and just letting the universe take its course, letting nature dictate the path.
Of course, even then you're bound to get a few flowers.
So I think the conclusion is that the apparent labeling of weeds has to do with the difficulty one has in controlling their spread. And, of course, this can be explained to the spiritually available person as the competition between two gardeners.
Well, and let me interject here and loop in our previous discussion. By this definition, are men not just weeds?
Because it is impossible to destroy the men?
No, because they contain within them millions and millions of seed, and they spread so prodigiously and so effectively. While the women, like delicate flowers, can only have one offspring at a time.
Well, Aurora, I think that we rarely would regard the male and female of one species to be weed and non-weed. I think, indeed, what happens is the entire species is so labeled.
This is merely an analogy and to bring forth the point that it does not matter whether one can carry millions of seed and spread so easily that the labels are even, and so the weed can be beautiful to one viewer. The grass can be so soft and yielding beneath one's toes.
Well, I wanted to bring in some perspective from the Talmud, something I never quite understood, but the Talmud teaches that the male reproduction, the male, the sperm, is what provides the bones and the blood vessels of the child, and it is the female egg which provides the flesh. And I've always puzzled over this. Is this some sort of metaphor? Is it some strange medical view of the time? I don't quite know if it has any meaning or not.
Well, I think it must be metaphor. Otherwise, it's simply wrong.
Well, that according to modern science, at least.
Precisely, of course, according to the modern
One view. Day we may discover different.
Right, mm-hmm. But I wonder what would it mean that the father contributes the bones and the mother contributes the flesh.
Well, one may imagine. No, please, Aurora.
I believe this can lead back to the canonical childhood and the raising of the children, that back in those times of the Talmud, the father provided the structure of the household, provided the flow and ebb of the blood, while the woman provided the softness. She provided the resilience. She raised the child with soft, enduring understanding, which is the flesh, while the father was more stern and provided the structure on which the flesh can spread itself.
It is in this way very metaphorical. I was thinking a possible literal meaning would be that certain biologically interesting structures were determined by the genetic contribution of the one parent versus the other.
Hmm.
Well, we know today that there's mitochondrial DNA structures which we inherit only from our mothers.
Mm. Indeed.
So perhaps all we need is to find the other piece from the fathers.
Let's bring a final caller in to join us. Caller, welcome.
Yeah, hi. No, it's Scott. I shut the phone off because my beard is scruffing the My beard is scruffing the telephone.
No,
I'm
Scott,
sorry.
There are so many beautiful sounds in the world, and a beard scruffing against the phone should not be discounted.
It's more my fault.
Well, thank you for returning.
Well, Scott, what kind of beard have you cultivated?
Less than a day and a half. Timothy Leary was buried in space with Gene Roddenberry.
Buried in space?
Yes, with Gene Roddenberry. Oh. Actually, Dr. Timothy Leary of Harvard University was sent up in a rocket
after death with Gene Roddenberry, the creator of Star Trek.
Is it not ironic that we would call this buried in space
when
in reality all people are buried in space, and this one creature was by exception simply emitted into space?
I would say that perhaps we here on the Earth are all buried halfway in ground beneath us.
Well, of course, we're
in
all
space,
hurtling.
We're more free.
We're hurtling through space, and our vehicle is merely the planet Earth.
Mm.
Or perhaps one could say our tomb.
Mm.
Now, I must say personally, as one proponent of natural burials, that this is in a way robbing the Mother Earth of all of the nutrients you have absorbed and burying yourself away from her.
But yet, perhaps it's a purge of Gene Roddenberry.
Or perhaps another planet may benefit from this organic material sent its way. It could be that this very body will actually seed life on some faraway system.
I am interested in the circularity. Gene Roddenberry directed a show where people got sent out into space after dying, and yet he too ended up that way.
Hmm.
And
so
was
it
considered a terrifying circumstance, or how was it portrayed in this show?
As beautiful and meaningful.
Hmm. Well,
perhaps we all
become what we create.
What we will.
There is a part of us that discovers reality around us and interprets it through our own interpretations. And through that, we view the world as we see fit, so perhaps all of reality is only our own impressions and our own ideas projected onto ourselves.
Perhaps we create only what we are already.
One could think back to the question of the fortune cookie and consider that what we eat is what we will become. For much as Ulysses' ship, the boards change continually over the course of the journey, leaving him with a different ship. We become and change into that which we have eaten.
Yes, and I think extending this idea, we talked several weeks ago about the Amish cookie. The Amish cookie, of course, is created through a communal social process whereby one person's flour from their cookie becomes one of the pieces of raw material for the next person's cookie. And in a way, all our dough becomes...
It's only like a day's worth of growth.
A day's worth of growth. The beard,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. But going back to the cookie, though, the Amish cookie, it sort of... The dough can actually contain dough from hundreds of years of other Amish cookies, combining and recombining and recombining and combining. And so, too, I think our bodies become the raw material for other bodies.
It's an excellent metaphor, really, because it's very genuine. It's true. Likewise, my beard has been growing for only a day, but it grows so rapidly that you may even hear it rustling during the program.
Which forces one to consider, is your beard a weed or is it a flower?
It is a weed that I must constantly battle.
I see it as a flower.
Zoro, you have a very unusual view. But it is one which I appreciate very much.
You're welcome.
And Aurora.
Yes.
You were saying about the mixture of life.
Well, it's such a recurring theme. And I believe the reason for that, the theme of mixing and becoming a part of something so much more enormous than you, the fact that you have this cookie that has been a cookie for thousands of people before you. And I believe this speaks back to the echoes of desperation, the feeling that we long so much to be physically connected, as we truly are spiritually connected, though so many of us are blind to it.
Once, when I was young, I was given a loaf of Amish friendship bread, which I think is similar to your cookie, before taking a very, very long journey.
And was this journey a success?
Yes.
Well, everyone, I'm so sorry, but we are just reaching now the end of the hour. So thanks very much to our caller, Scott.
Thank you. Good night.
Good evening, Scott. And thanks also to our newcomer, Stanislaw.
Thank you very much for this time.
And to Dr. L.
I appreciate it as well.
Thanks also to Zorro.
My pleasure.
And to Aurora.
Namaste.
And once again, of course, to Professor Levine.
You're welcome.
I am Addictor Giles Sakran here on Music for Human, New Age Talk Radio, with an emphasis on you, here on WMBR Cambridge every Friday at 7 p.m. Stay tuned next for Hipster Happy Hour. Ma'a salama.
Safety.
Number one,
cars and bikes stop at red lights.
It's against the law for car drivers or bicycle riders to ignore traffic signals.
So don't buzz through red lights. There might be a pedestrian or turning car that doesn't see you coming.
Number two,
look first before you open your door.
Numerous bicyclists have been injured or even killed by car doors suddenly opening into them.
Look first, and bicyclists, stay out of the door zone.
Number three,
cross with the signal.
You are safest if you wait for a walk or green traffic signal.
Don't jaywalk. That's just walking into trouble.
Number four,
cars and bikes should stop for pedestrians in unsignalized crosswalks.
Be nice. Be legal. Be safe.
Brought to you as a public service by the Cambridge Bicycle Committee and this station.
Welcome to another episode of Hipster Happy Hour. Tonight's mix is a little bit of a departure from the usual fare that I play on here. Lots of sad music. I'm calling it the sad edition. Don't worry though, there's still plenty of the usual pretension, except this time it's more of the post-rock variety. But besides that, there's plenty of stuff coming up that I am very excited about. Let's see, we've got some Destroyer, which I don't think I've given a shout out on this show yet, because it seems I don't go by one week without playing a Destroyer track. So Destroyer, great band. Other things coming up include Modest Mouse, Animal Collective, Zola Jesus, all that and more in the next hour. This is WMBR Cambridge.